Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Thriller Zone. I'm your host, David Temple. Today's guest will need very little introduction for many writers in the self-publishing space. Kevin Tomlinson is a prolific self-published author with no less than 40 books to his credit. But Kevin also hosts a podcast and acts as director of marketing for Draft to Digital. We'll speak with him in just a moment. But first, a quick programming note before we start. If you like what you hear today on the podcast, on any one of the nearly dozen podcast channels, or what you see on our YouTube channel at David Temple Author, first of all, we say thank you for listening. Secondly, I wonder if you'd take just a quick minute to give us a five-star review or click to subscribe to our channel. And thank you. Now, let's meet Kevin Tomlinson in The Thriller Zone. We're just going to jump right in here because, like, we knew what we were doing. I'm here on the Thriller Zone podcast with an old friend. He's an author, a podcast host of the Wordslinger podcast, and is in his spare time. He's a director of marketing for Draft to Digital.
Yeah.
Kevin Tomlinson.
Spare time. Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Dave.
No, thank you. We've only been talking about this for years, so it's about time we did it.
I had you on. No, I didn't have you on my show, did I? I've never had you on the Wordslinger podcast.
Yeah.
And then I went and kind of retired it a little. It'll be back. It's on hiatus, but I'll have to get you on.
That's not fair. No, it's not. It's funny because I was drilling down on you and I'm like, he's got a, 2020. Oh, it's not really today.
Yeah, it's not active. Yeah. So as you know, I mean, we got on the road in a van, doing a whole hashtag van life. And it got really challenging to keep things like that up. And I say that, and then I'm doing another show I'm doing two other podcasts, one with Nick Thacker, who's another thriller author.
Right.
And then I'm doing one for Draft to Digital. Nick takes care of all the production side for that podcast that I do with him. And then the one I do with D2D, it's kind of a little easier to produce. So,
well,
that's the way it goes.
Let me tell you, someone asked me the other day, said, you know, they wanted to get on the show and so forth. And, you know, well, I can do any day. And I'm like, well, I've only got like really one day to record. Takes another day to edit.
Yeah.
And then maybe a third day, you know, between preparing and then posting. I mean, it's you don't just throw these things together. If they look thrown together sometimes.
Sometimes, but yeah, they look like they just sort of naturally happen.
Yeah.
So when you're really good at it, no one can see the work. You know, that's the point, right?
I hope so.
You've got it down. No one can see your work. So now you got to start showing your work, Dave.
Well, it's the double duty too, Kev. It's the, you know, and I'm taking this from you, but you got the YouTube action going and then you got the podcast itself.
Right.
And because, as you know, I came from a TV and radio background with the TV background, I gotta have all the bells and whistles. It's got to look good.
Oh, I know, man. I know.
If it doesn't look good, you're going to go, oh.
That's why I feel so bad. We had this conversation before the show started because my lighting is not great. And the first thing I said, what did I say? Because I knew. And if I could face the window, I would. But then you'd be looking at a bunch of
hanging laundry
stuff. Yeah, it's not. We're kind of in a temporary spot while we wait for a house to be built. So,
well, yeah, let's talk that about folks. Yeah. We're going to get to compromised his. Very
new one. Yeah.
This is the newest Alex Kane thriller. We're going to get to that, but I want to get some background for folks who don't know Kevin Tomlinson, which I can't imagine anyone in this space doesn't, in the thriller podcasting, YouTubing, self-publishing world. So we're going to get to that. But now last time we spoke, you were on the road. We have a mutual buddy, a very crazy lunatic, Todd Huey.
Yeah.
And whom I haven't spoken to in quite some time, but he introduced us and you packed up your house, sold it and bought an RV and just hit the road, right?
We've done that a couple of times since then, actually. So yeah, we sold our first home. We bought an RV, got on the road. And we didn't get to do everything we had wanted to do. We were kind of locked. We were sort of landlocked for a little while because my wife, Kara, was working locally in Houston. And, you know, so we would take some trips, but we'd have to hightail it back to Houston. And so there was a point at which we were basically sleeping in this like oversized tin can in a parking lot, basically, because we were staying in an RV park here in the Houston area. So we got off the road, we got into an apartment and then another apartment, and we were out house hunting one day. We decided we would buy a house. And so we were looking around a little more, and Kara says, why are we doing this? Like, why not just get back on the road for a while? So long story short, we ended up in a travel van, a camper van. So the whole van life thing, that's where we've been for, we're going on about 2 years now. Just moving around the country. That was our COVID escape pod during 2020. Nothing says social distancing like being 2,000 miles from the nearest, you know, human soul. So, nice. You know, I did that, wrote books on the road, but now we're building a house. We're building a place just north of Austin, kind of close to where, not too far from where Elon Musk is kind of settling in. So
I was going to say, yeah, we just announced this on a show recently. He's bailing California, moving primary facilities to Austin.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's not the only one. There's a big, like, I'm calling it Cal exit. A lot of people are moving from California to
Texas. Yeah, we know it well. Someone asked us the other day about Tammy and I live in San Diego, North County, which is Encinitas. So it's a little laid back hippie surfing town.
That's what you want.
It is so delicious. The thing is flip flops and t-shirts and
you know, fit right in, man. Business, would fit right in.
Yes, you would. Business meetings are usually on the beach or, you know, over a surfboard or a coffee. Or craft beer. And
Or all the above
simultaneously. But there has been a mass exodus between the fires and the earthquakes and the taxes and the real estate and ad nauseum. And you know, we'll probably face that reality one day as well, because you know, it's not to belabor it, but it's tough to own a home here when your down payment is $250,000.
Yeah, exactly.
Austin's sweet. We have had a lot of authors from Austin on the show.
It's become a self-publishing mecca. I noticed that it started happening a few years ago. I don't know if you've ever met or maybe you've interviewed or talked to Johnny, Sean, and Dave from the self-publishing podcast.
Okay.
They were kind of OG self-publishing podcasters, really. And Johnny Truant and Sean Platt, they're both in Austin now. You know, because of those guys, there began to be this like influx of authors in that area. I know there's other things going on, but that was, you know, how I kind of learned about the self-publishing scene was from those guys. I'm going to start hobnobbing with all the local authors there for once without having to pay for a conference.
Nice. I thought I was really surprised when I know we're off the beaten path, but screw it. We
that's the way I am. My whole life is off the beaten path, man.
Beautiful. I think that's the name of my next book. but when I saw Joe Rogan bail on Pacific Palisades to go to Austin, I'm like, holy balls. Now that's a move.
Oh yeah. We'll welcome you when you finally come around. You're welcome. Well,
I do want to see Austin. I've never seen Austin.
Oh man. Okay. Well, look, when we're moved in, you've got an open invitation. Come out, hang out. I'll take you. Hopefully by then I'll know some hot places to go, and
hot dog.
We'll do it upright.
All right. Well, there we go. That's our geography lesson for the day. But I do want to spend a little bit of time more about your background from this standpoint, because I mean, let's talk about Drafted Digital, because this was one of the very first tools I put my hands around when I got into the self-publishing world, because what you do, and I'm going to let you explain it, provides such an invaluable service to guys like me who are self-published on our way to being traditionally published, we hope, you know, fingers crossed. So tell us about Drafted Digital, and how did you get to be the director of marketing and find things?
It was one of those. Well, first of all, Drafted Digital, what we are is we're known as a publishing aggregator, which means that you can bring in your manuscript as like a Word file or whatever. We'll convert it for you to an EPUB and we'll distribute that for you to all the major retailers. And our cut is basically we take like a 15% cut of royalties by the time it's all said and done. It's like 10% to us, 5% to the retailer, and you get the rest and you own your book. We don't own anything at all. We have a whole bunch of like cool layout tools to make it look good. We got like this cover tool for print books now. We have a whole DDD print thing now. So the point of Drafts Digital is to make it easy for you to publish and reach all the retailers, which means making more sales. So sure. We only make money when you make money. That's our kind of claim to fame. And we are, our customer support is, you know, everyone loves us. If you Google Drafts Digital and customer support, we will blush because there's some very nice things being said about us out there. So the way I came around to them was because of the Wordslinger podcast. I got into this space. I started publishing. It was doing pretty okay. And I had the show. And so I started kind of bringing on people from this space because I wanted to learn more. And I wanted to pick people's brains and have a good excuse for doing it. You know, I'm sure you can relate.
Sure.
And I brought on Dan Wood, who is now, he just got promoted to the chief operating officer of D2D. So he's gotten a big promotion since I met him, too, in fact. And I interviewed him, talked about the program, talked about how things worked. And then when it was all said and done and we hung up, I said, hey, you know, I own a small, you know, private marketing company. I do a lot of copywriting, marketing work. If you guys ever need a hand, let me know. Cause my goal was to get a foot in with Draft to Digital just to kind of learn more. Sure. It was like a month later, he contacted me, put me in touch with their owners. And they're like, you know, at first it was going to be like this contractor thing. And I helped them launch their tool, Universal Book Links. And they liked me so much and I liked them so much. We all started working together. So
awesome.
Even as the books have gotten better and better and done better and now make me a very comfortable living. Suddenly I found that I was involved in this community that I just really loved. And so and with this group of people that I really loved. So that's how the whole thing started and how it's going.
That's a great story. I think also I did watch one of your shows with Joanna Penn. Joanna's one of those gals who, man, I've never seen anybody. She's not knuckle deep. She's arm deep into everything between audiobooks and regular books and PDFs and ebooks and hardbacks. Everything.
And she's a futurist.
She really is.
She is.
But it takes people like her. And, you know, people like her can prove to you that self-publishing is the only way to go.
Yeah.
It's so funny. And without this, because this is about thrillers, but I do like the talk of technology with it. You can talk to a lot of people and go, they'll only feel validated when they get traditionally published.
Right.
There are those that, Mark Dawson's, that say, you know, I've been there, done that. I'm making more money here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So exact same. I'm one of those guys that sits on the fence because I haven't mastered the self-publishing to the level and degree that you have with 40 plus books, but you know, and I probably still have enough of the naivete to think that traditional publishing is the panacea. But then I hear, I just read something recently about the percentage of people who actually get any notoriety at all. And traditional publishing is negligible.
It's very negligible, yeah. In fact, if you don't come in with a platform and an audience, your chances of building one are very slim. So, and this is not down, I'm not down on traditional publishing, by the way. I'm actually currently working with a publisher for a side project, and we'll see how it goes. But you know, I'm not opposed to getting a traditional contract. One thing that I did, and one thing that I think a lot of indie authors are doing is, you know, you spend all that time building up your audience, building up your platform. And when you do get to a point where someone's interested in you from the traditional world, you have a lot more leverage. Like I can actually dictate terms now where I, you know, before I couldn't, when I had my, first contract, I couldn't do, I didn't have any say. So now it's sort of a you know, I don't need you. You may not need me, but I also don't need you. So we can come at this as equals, you know? So that's a good feeling, but it's also a good business strategy when it all comes down to it. Like, you're able to negotiate a much better deal than you would otherwise.
All right, folks, let me do this real quick so that you get a real good handle on who we're talking to here. This besides compromise, which I began the show with. Check this out. We've got an Alex Kane series, Dan Kotler archaeological series, historic crimes crossover series, the standalone Evergreen, the Lucid series with Nick Thacker that we heard mentioned earlier, the Think Tank episodes, a sci-fi series, a fantasy series, and a collection of short fiction. Holy bananas. I knew you were an avid writer, but I really didn't have my stupidity. I didn't have any idea that you had been at this to this degree until I really dove into your site.
It's a lot. I've come to realize it's a lot over the years. Cause to me, it was just on to the next project. You know, each time I'd finish one, I just immediately start the next one. It's almost like being an avid reader. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm telling myself I'm a pantser, meaning I don't plot, I don't outline. So I'm what they call a discovery writer. And which, by the way, you know, Stephen King, he's also a discovery writer. So I'm in good company, right? But I would sit down and write the book. And as soon as I was done, I'd pass it on to editors and I'd go to the next book. And that one after another. I mean, there was a time where I really was churning out a book a month, sometimes two in a month. And those days were exhausting days. I wasn't working with Draft to Digital at that point, so it was a little easier to divide my time up for that. But yeah, that's what it's about.
That's what it takes. How many books total? And don't count the little short fiction, you know, 100-page dudes. Give me the.
If we're taking the short stories, the individual like novellas and stuff out, I mean, there's at least 30 full length books out there. It's hard for me to put a number on things like that because I have books in various stages of completion.
I got you. James and Patterson, so, go ahead. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. So, and I'm partnered with some people for a couple of things. And so it's like, what counts as a book at this point? When you start looking into like, how long is a book? You'll see things like, okay, a novella is 30,000 words. You'll see that somewhere. But then you'll find out that all of Ian Fleming's James Bond books were 30 to 40,000 words.
Is now that true?
Yeah, I've actually gone and counted. Yeah, I did that whole calculation on like three or four of his books. And turns out, yeah, they're like 40,000 was a long James Bond book. So, and a lot of the Pulp Fiction books were, you know, under 60,000 words.
Right.
So now if you go by like, National Novel Writing Month from NaNoWriMo, right?
Right.
Those guys, their word target was 50,000, right? Uh-huh. So I read Chris's book, No Plot, No Problem, way, way back. He said in the book that when he decided he wanted to try to write a book in a month, he needed a target. And so he just sort of arbitrarily landed on 50,000 words. So that's not like a set in stone length for minimum length for a book. It's just what he decided. But that's what a lot of people, I now use that as sort of my metric, but most of my books are in the 80,000 word range, somewhere around there.
Okay. I want to break this down a second because this beats on the back of my head, Kevin, all the time because I have the ability, I think natural ability. I'm just like you. I sit down, I have an idea, just a seed of an idea. And I'm almost better at if I just run with it and go willy-nilly. Yeah. Writing 50,000 in a month for NaNoWriMo, easy. Done it. My first three books were that way. Yeah. Then I go to conference. I'm not bad-mouthing any conferences or whatever. I go to conferences and there, you know, you'll hear certain agents and people, not mentioning names.
Right.
Oh, you got to beat out the outlines and the systems. Okay, here's the thing. So then I've studied the Save the Cat.
Yep.
I've studied the, I'm not going to bore you with all the
details. Snowflake, have you done that one?
Snowflake, Michael Hogg.
Three-story method.
All yeah, there's as many different methods as there are stories, almost.
Yeah.
And here's my bottom line. There are times, and this last book that's over my shoulder there, The Imposter, I did that systematically because I was damned and determined to prove it. I took the Save the Cat, Blake Snyder's adaptation by another woman, and I did it to the nth degree. Each beat was a certain way, each length. I mean, it's scientific. All right. Was it as much fun? No.
No, I wouldn't think so. But
now the gal who edited it said, wow, this hits all the points just right. Okay. Now the sales have not been what the poser was, the one before that I wrote off the top of my head over a period of about 2 years. So I'll get to the bottom line. I don't think there is a or a B, a better or a worse, a right.
I don't think so either. I think that it comes down to what works for you, what's comfortable for you, and what's going to give you the eye. I'm an odds guy. Okay. When I talk about marketing, I tell people my definition of marketing is improving the odds that the right customer will find your book at the right time, the time they're ready to purchase it. You know, it's all about improving odds. When it comes to writing methods and writing techniques, you can try every one there is. Like you said, there's a writing method for every type of book, right? Yep. Or for every type of story there is out there, you can find one. But it doesn't matter if you've got the perfect outline, if you don't actually finish a book. It doesn't matter if you, you know, have the perfect outline, if you write a book nobody wants to read.
That's a key.
That's what it's come down to, right? So, and I'd say also, you know, you can't judge how well a book is written by its sales either, because if, you know, there's a lot of factors that would determine whether or not someone actually picks up the book, everything from the cover to the book description, you know, to even just the little tagline at the top of the book's product page, you know, that could turn someone off. So you kind of got, I hate that we have to rely so heavily on things like reviews, but it's really the only metric I know to determine whether or not a book's a hit, because sales can be great, but if you got $10,000 worth of sales that month from that book, and then every single review is a one star because it's written so poorly, then did you succeed? I don't think so. You know, you succeeded at being an author. You succeeded at writing a book. Congratulations. And that's definitely something to celebrate and be proud of. I'm proud of you. But if you wrote a book nobody likes, they're not going to recommend it to anybody. They're not going to read the next book you wrote. So yeah, that's how you kind of gauge.
Well, folks, Kevin's website is kevintumlinson.com. And if you go on there, you're going to see real quickly that he's a guy who knows what he's talking about. Go to the books page, which I'm not going to drill down too far on this, but there's just book after book after book. But Kevin, let me share something with you. I literally saw this morning. I usually get up around 5 o'clock, about 5:30. I'm just drilling through your website and I'm like, oh, okay, look at that. And here's some, my wife's in there having some coffee. I said, honey, you're not going to believe this. Now, I've never told you this. Okay. This blows my mind. I'm going to come back to your,
I'm ready.
Yeah. My brother-in-law, Tammy's brother, is Tim Buss.
Oh, same Tim Buss? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Tim Buss of Chicago Cubs, Bussy.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's him. He has two boys. I love these boys. These boys are gold. I love them.
Right.
We hang out all the time. I'm going to tell you their names in a second. And I hang out with these guys and I go, I'm going to write a series that's about you guys. And the oldest guy is Jackson and the youngest boy is Sawyer.
Really?
So I was tempted. It was originally going to be a character named Sawyer Jackson.
Really?
The way I'm going to get around this without, just so you know, this has been in the works for a couple of years here. I just haven't sat down and done it, but it's going to be The Adventures of Sawyer and Jackson and the Wonder Dog Dexter, which is my dog.
Okay. All right.
So I'm going to be able to get around that.
That's fine.
You don't look at me and go,
we're going to end up in each other's also bots is what's going to happen. So,
but dude, what are the chances of that happening? How did you come up with Sawyer Jackson?
Okay. every year on Halloween, we get together with some friends, this particular group of friends, and we have movie and game nights for Halloween. Okay. And we were playing Seen It. You remember Seen It? Where you play a DVD and there's various types, but one of them is like TV.
Seen It.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there was a question on there, and I forget the question, but the answer was, you know, S blank, 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 and then blank Axon. And it gave a little hint, and we had to, you had like 5 seconds to be the first to guess. And I said, I saw it and I said, Sawyer Jackson. It was Samuel Jackson. And but that stuck, and it was so funny. So, but after it was all said and done, I said, you know, I'm going to have to write something with that name.
Well, so I'll either use it as a pen name, so I'm going on record now, or it's probably going to be the two characters. But I saw that I could not wait to tell you that. That's so hilarious.
That's so funny. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go back to this long list, because the series that really is, it looks like it's put you on the map. And I want to talk about your book covers in a second, because these are dynamite. And that's that would be the, well, it's a toss up, but no, I guess it's, yeah, I guess it's Dan Kotler is really your most prolific series, isn't it? Yeah.
That's the big one. Yeah. Like most good things in my life, it started with a dare.
Tell me about that.
My friend Nick Thacker and I were doing a different podcast than we do now. We were doing a podcast called Self-Publishing Answers. He's been a thriller writer since he started. You know, he's a big fan of like James Rollins and Steve Barry and guys like that. And we were talking about, so I don't even know what the topic of the show was, but it kind of came around that because I, at the time, I was writing science fiction and fantasy and was pretty dedicated to it. I was doing pretty okay with it too. And he dared me to write a thriller. And so I took that dare. And then I went and mined a bunch of my like story starters, you know, stuff, what I call my thirds or first thirds. They were books that I had started, but never finished. And I usually wrote like the first third of it. Sure. So I started kind of mining all that to see, you know, if I had anything I could convert into a thriller. I ended up grabbing like 4 or 5 different pieces and putting them together and sort of reorganizing it. And that became it's pronounced Coelho Medallion. And it's spelled Coelho, but it's named for Paulo Coelho, the writer, the author of the Alchemist.
Sure.
So that was the kick of that whole thing too, was that I wrote that book and it was filled with like allusions to, you know, little in jokes about other authors. The character's name is Dan Kotler. He's named for Dan Brown and Jeffrey Kotler. Inadvertently I named his buddy, I won't call him a sidekick because I think he would actually come to life just to kick my ass. But, there's a character named Roland Denzel, who's he's a FBI agent and ends up being partners with Kotler, but he shares a name with a very, very good friend of mine now, who I didn't know when I started writing the books, but I have a friend named Roland Denzel, who is also an author. So, and he's actually teased, he's like, I'm going to have to write under a pen name because I can't, no one will ever find my books because every time you type in my name in Amazon, your books come up. So I had no idea when I did it that would become my, like, the series I'm known for. Like, it just took off. It just, that first book came out in 2016. We had just gotten on the road in the RV. Like, literally, I pressed publish on that book while we were sitting in a parking lot in Iowa to meet my deadline. And it just exploded and people loved it. And I put out the next one, which also had some author in names, in jokes. It's called The Atlantis Riddle. And the in joke was, Nick and I had joked on air because there was A.G. Riddle wrote that whole Atlantis series. And I said, well, I should write a book called The Atlantis Riddle. And so I did. And then that book took off and it's just been one after the other now. I'm 12 full length novels in on that. I can't write them fast enough to satisfy the audience on those books.
Dude, that's the best problem you could possibly have, isn't it?
Yeah, it is good. I won't lie.
Who does the covers? Because they're dynamite.
I do the covers, actually. I have a design background, so I've been doing my covers since the beginning, which initially was all about saving myself that cost, because, you know, self-publishers have to pay for everything. But then it just became, it kind of became part of how I finished the book now. Once I'm done with the book, designing the cover is sort of my cap to it.
Dude, these are probably the best self-artisted. I just hacked the hell out.
You're a writer. Yeah, writers are allowed to invent words. It's fine.
Yeah. these are some of the best self-made covers I've seen. Now, I did a couple of my first and they showed it. I think the average bear for a good cover is going to cost you, I have found, somewhere in that $300 to $600 range.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here's something that surprises me is when I run across authors who are really, really serious about their craft, Kev, and then their covers just suck balls. Yeah. I mean, they're just so bad. I'm like, dude, are you kidding me? How can you put that cover on that book? Oh, I think it looks great.
I don't get it either, but there's a blind spot, right? I always tell authors, you know, you should take that cover, take the design that you think is good, shrink it down, right? And then just overlay it on a page of Amazon results for books in the same genre and look at it and ask yourself, does this fit? Like, does that look like the other books? Because, you know, everyone's always very concerned about, they want a cover that's very original. But that's not necessarily the best advice. No. You want a cover that you really want a cover that reminds readers of the last book that they read and loved. You want them to see your book and say, I like books like that, and then go read that book. So being original is not necessarily the best plan.
Folks, that is a little gem. That is going to make the highlight reel of Kevin Tomlinson's podcast. Yeah. That is absolutely true. And I'm going to say this one more time, and I try not to geek out too much over too much. I just need to keep moving on. But because I've studied them so long, and here's the funny thing about good cover. You look at it, boom, you know, in seconds, you know, in 3 seconds, if it's going to be good or not. And these are all hits. All right. I've done enough.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. And they didn't start that way. Of course, you know, I just like everybody else, I got my not so great stuff. They say that, you know, there's that adage that the first million words are practice. And I think that really applies to just about anything you do. In a way, it's almost easier to design the Kotler covers because they are meant to be this like Indiana Jones-esque adventure books. They remind me a lot of the kind of books I read when I was growing up.
Dude, they're so dense and they're so complex. That's why I like them so much.
Yeah, I like, and there's hidden gems in every single cover.
Oh, of course there is.
So I'm big on Easter eggs and hidden stuff. And one of the things I did early on, I made a decision from book one, even when I wasn't sure I would even write another book, I made a decision that if I wrote a series or wrote multiple books, every single book I ever wrote would somehow be tied to the others. So even the sci-fi, the fantasy, all that stuff. In fact, big reason I wrote those Sawyer Jackson books was because he's traveling the multiverse, you know, so that I could connect all the other books. Anything I write outside of those thrillers can still be connected by some little thread. So if you go book to book to book, there is some thread that connects it to the rest of my universe, I guess. So
not that you have the time, as we established at the beginning of the show, but if you had the time, even for a little weekend crash course, I'd sign up for it. If you did a crash course on how to do layout for a book cover, I'd jump on that bandwagon, baby.
Yeah, and I'll have to consider it.
But Kevin, you also brought up a really good point, is that the people who are looking on Amazon, we'll use Amazon as the example, for that particular kind of read, they know when they see that cover, I'm buying it. My mother used to do that. Oh, I'm buying it. It's an Amish romance story. I'm buying it. It's got an Amish. I'm buying it. I don't care what it says. When did this fascination of history and archaeology start with you? It had to be back as a kid. I mean,
yeah, definitely. Back, I still have things from when I was, you know, as young as like 6 years old that, you know, they would sometimes send out. So my family subscribed to National Geographic. I remember there being this bookcase full of them, you know? And so I was constantly looking through that stuff. They would send promotional materials that had images and things, right? Like the Great Pyramids, or they'd have like this sticker that would be one of those like reflective, shimmering hologram, right? Uh-huh. That's exactly the word I was looking for. And it would be like the all-seeing eye or something. So I have these big like poster board size pieces of art paper where I drew stuff and put that stuff on it to make my own like maps, treasure maps, or you know, whatever. And then I loved Indiana Jones. I watched that over and over again as a kid. Anything that was related to that. But as I grew up, the weird history was the stuff that always caught my attention, you know, which is what the Kotler books kind of started as, still are, the sort of quirks of history, you know. Things like, you know, the latest Kotler book is called The Demon Corps, and it's a sort of what if story, like, you know, what if, because there was a third plutonium core that did not get used on Hiroshima. So there was Little Boy and Fat Man, the two bombs that were dropped on Japan.
Sure.
And there was a third that would have been, but it ended up going to Los Alamos, where two like idiotic scientists within the span of 9 months killed themselves by being morons. You'll just have to read the history to get the backup on that. But they basically did something stupid, killed themselves and some others. And so they melted that core down, but it got the nickname the Demon Core because of that, those incidents. So I wrote a story that was sort of a what if someone had stolen that and replaced it with something that got melted down. And their intention was to sell it to the highest bidder, but then something goes wrong, history goes on without recording any of it. And then someone in the modern day discovers it and decides to put it to work as a dirty bomb.
Two little tangents here for you. A little two 1 degree of separation. A little known facts. My great uncle was part of the crew that worked on Fat Man.
Oh, okay.
And number two is you're a fan. Have you ever been to Disneyland and seen Indiana Jones and Temple of the Forbidden Eye?
So no, because I've never been to Disneyland since I was maybe an infant. I've been to every one but the one in California.
When you go to the one in Disneyland,
yeah,
and you go into the ride and you hear Indiana Jones swinging from the rafters and doing all that stuff.
Yeah. That's you?
That's my voice.
All right. Okay.
A little claim to fame.
All right. Well, then I will definitely. Now, you didn't do the voice for the one in Disney World then.
My contract was only for Disneyland. Okay. That was back when I was working in Hollywood. You know, we've talked about this other series, but let's talk about Alex Kane. Let's talk about this gal. She's an ass-kicking machine.
She is.
Smart little cookie. And why does she have this guy on her tail?
So the premise of that, Alex Kane invented a quantum-based AI that is basically a skeleton key for anything digital. She can essentially just glide right through any sort of digital security. She can use it to, it's smart, so it can kind of do things on her behalf. It was intended to, she had originally intended it to sort of revolutionize personal data security for the world. But of course, people saw the potential in using it in the opposite way. And that got her, that brought her to the attention of certain entities in the world, like world governments that were bent on owning this, or at least keeping other governments from having access to it. So she ends up being framed for espionage and murder. Her business partner is murdered by the Russians, of all things. But she's framed for that, and framed for espionage, framed for being a traitor to her country. So she is the single most wanted person on the planet at this point for a variety of reasons. So she uses this AI to stay one step ahead of everyone. But because she's a noble soul, she does the whole A-team thing. She goes and helps people who are basically disenfranchised by the people who are supposed to protect them, the people who've fallen through the cracks of like the FBI and CIA and that sort of thing.
All the alphabets are chasing her. And I love this notorious, that con man that's thinks that she's fallen right into his web, but she is, she's a smart cookie. I love the fact that you've got a gal who is this kind of superhero. I'm a big fan of female superheroes, and that's what she feels like. I do want you to help me understand what you call it, Quake, but it's spelled Q-U-I-E-K.
Right.
So break that down for me.
That stands for Quantum Integrated Encryption Key. And much like the origin of the acronym SHIELD from Avengers, it is an acronym that was specifically created so that I can make the word Quake.
And this technology, excuse my ignorance, this technology does not exist in any way, shape, or form that you know of?
It, in fact, does exist, perhaps not to the level that I've developed it in this book, but, you know, it's a combination of a variety of technologies that are real. Quantum computing is real. AI is real. This is a could-be technology, something that is sort of not quite like self-aware or anything, and it doesn't talk to her or anything like that, but what it does is respond to her. And in this book, I actually have her experimenting with some new ways of communicating with it that I haven't used before. So it was a lot of fun to write that.
What do you think about AI and the way that it's going? I just saw a robot recently on the news that it was standing and was walking along a wire and balancing itself by reading all the algorithms of balance and the space around it.
Unlike a lot of folks, I've never been afraid of the idea of artificial intelligence. I'm very much excited about it. I do see how there could be a kind of danger, but I don't think it's a danger we could prevent. Like, I don't think it's anything we could navigate around. If there's going to be a rise of Terminator-like machines, there's nothing we're ever going to be able to do about it. It's going to happen with or without us.
Right.
But what I see in the field of AI is how it is just opening doors to some incredibly useful tools for humanity. You know, things like, if you really think about it, like if you've got an advanced enough AI, we have technology that can, if someone has a spinal cord injury, we have technology that will allow science to bypass the damage and send signals to the body beyond the damage. Well, an AI could actually manage that and actually help assist in getting people walking again, getting them to use prosthetic limbs, getting them, you know, all the things, maybe even helping them to restore sight. I mean, artificial intelligence has the potential, at least, to open some doors to assistive technology like we've never seen before.
So. And isn't nanotechnology, the machines that are able to go into the body as small as a cell practically and help repair and or destroy cancer and teach the body to eliminate certain things?
And there has been a lot of experimentation with developing nanotech. I forget the name now, but there's this element, carbon-based element that they've created that is a superconductor. They've actually built tiny little robots. And they're not the robots like we think about. Like, they're not a bunch of circuits. They're essentially one or two cells that are sort of programmed they call it like mimetic movement, things like that. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that you can do. And if you can get to that level and have control over something that can, say, move a cell. And if you have, say, a cancer cell, you know, there's no reason we couldn't create technology that could go in and, if not eliminate that cell, then move it out of the way, maybe pass it along into the urine stream or something, you know.
Sure. Just, it's very clear that Alex is going to be around a while, as evidenced by the
popular
end of the, very evidence at the end of the story. Now let me ask you this. There's three stories: Shaken, Triggered, and Compromised. Right. What is next for Alex? I'm guessing there's a fourth one out sitting there on the shelf for you right now.
There will be. I've not written it yet, but I do know what I'm writing. I have a couple of different titles that I'm kicking around. Once I land on the title, I will write the book. One of the big things that's happening with Alex Kane, though, is I created this idea of the historic crimes. That's a It's a sort of brand new law enforcement agency in the U.S. It sort of evolved from like a task force to become an agency of all its own. That's sort of the future for Alex Kane. Is she'll have her own ongoing series, but she's also going to be interacting. This may be how I bring some of my early stuff forward for my current readers.
All right. Makes sense.
Yeah.
So I noticed you dabbled in fantasy and sci-fi, as we mentioned, but you really have made your home in the world of thrillers. Is that safe to say?
Absolutely. Yeah. I want to go back and write more sci-fi and fantasy stuff, but most of the books I write now are in the thriller category.
Dude, so. I'm just going to say for the record, I'm very impressed. I'm very impressed. And it's not, you know, this is not candy, popcorn, rainbow, whatever I'm trying to say. This is good, straight ahead, page turning thriller stuff.
Well, so, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And well, that's the thing, right? I don't want anyone hearing this. If you're an aspiring author or will be author, what I don't like is for people to get discouraged. Like I've been doing this for a very long time. I've been writing professionally since I was 12 years old, you know, getting paid for it. I wrote my quote first book. It's like 5 pages on notebook paper when I was like 5, you know? So I've been doing this for a very, very long time. I don't want people hearing numbers and getting discouraged. You know, if you're writing a book a year, you're still doing something amazing and you should be proud of it.
Absolutely.
That's if there's any takeaway, I want it to be that.
Okay.
For the author community.
And dude, really, when you think about it, and let's be real pragmatic about it. By the time you come up with a solid idea, do your research, prepare can be outlined. You can pants it or you can outline it. By the time you do that. And then I like to live with an idea for a while. I'm golfing or I'm surfing or I'm hanging out with friends or I'm riding the bike or playing with the dog. And ask my wife, I'm always percolating. I'm always stirring that pot on the back of the stove. And I'm like, what about this? And what about that? And what if he has a friend like this? Dot, dot, dot. Right. And so by the time you do that, and then you sit down and then you write the first draft, and great upcoming episode with David McCloskey's talking about bringing your groceries home and putting them on the counter.
Yeah.
And that's draft one. And then mixing them together, that's draft two. And then baking it or cooking it, that's maybe draft three. Simmer it and then serve it, and accoutrement on top might be draft four. The point being, you know, by the time you do all that, now it's easy. And then you hand it off to an editor and beta readers, et cetera. So yeah, back to your point, a year? It's great. You just happen to have been at it for a long time, and your golf swing was probably sucky on day one, but you practiced for so many years, and now that swing is pretty decent.
And I've got it on good authority from early reviews that all my writing sucked when I first started. So
I have it on good authority. All right. One of my last questions before we roll into the rapid fire questions, what's the end game? When will you know that you have arrived? Or do you feel like there's a point where you're like, you know what? Yeah, I'm there. Do you feel like it's already there? Or do you think if I can get, what's the summit that you'll feel like you can kick back and smile and go, yeah, I got, whether it's money in the bank or another house or whatever that thing is.
I mean, officially, I won't stop writing. They'll find me like face down on my keyboard with like pencils taped to my palsied monkey paws so that I can keep typing to the very end, because deadlines don't care if you're dead. But in terms of success, I mean, I was telling people that I was at the Novelists Inc. Conference in St. Pete's Beach, Florida last month. One of the biggest author conferences, the most successful authors in the business go to this conference. And I was talking to some folks and I actually said, you know, I really do feel like in terms of success, I've already hit what I thought would be success. I've already reached it. And the thing about success is there's two concepts I think everyone, author or otherwise, should know or should keep in mind. First, success is a process, not a destination. It's all about what you're doing, right?
Yep.
And the second is success is what you bring with you, not what you get out of it. I bring success to this business, not the other way around. I'm not working for success. I'm working because success compels me to work. So that's really what it all comes down to. There's no actual end game for me. Death is the end game. And I'm a Christian and believer. So I believe God's probably going to put me in front of a keyboard, once I get up there. Or I hope he does.
And you'll be doing the marketing plan for his next Crystal Cathedral or whatever.
Right.
Golden building, whatever.
You can do worse than writing for the guy who authored the best-selling book of all time.
True. All right. As we begin to wrap up, I want to hit you with a few rapid-fire questions. Some are going to make sense. Some don't. It doesn't matter. It's my way of kind of just getting to know my buddy Kevin. If you could do anything in the world... And you can't say right in here, so I'm just going to take
it. Oh, my gosh. Here. Okay. You took away the only answer I ever give. Go ahead.
Money is of no consequence. Do anything else besides writing. You can still do writing on the side, but you can do anything in the world and with reckless abandon. What would it be?
It's hard to describe what this would be. I would open basically a Disney World-esque community park and, space, like a resort of sorts for the everyday common folks. That's what I would do. Mostly for writers. I'd open it mostly for writers.
I have never heard that answer before. That's good. Okay.
Okay.
Here's a strange one.
All right. That one wasn't strange. All right. Well,
no, that's pretty normal. If you came back in another life, and just bear with me on that phrase, Mr.
I'm good.
And you can be either a tree in the forest, an eagle in the open sky, or a lapdog of some rich and famous person, which would it be?
I would be the eagle. That's very suited to my independent nature. Yeah. You know?
Okay, you've just returned home to find your house is on fire.
Yes.
Your wife and your pets, they're out safe in the yard. And you don't have children, I'm pretty sure of that.
No kids.
Yeah. But you have to run into the house and rescue one prized possession. You're not going to get burned. But you can only have enough time to come in and get one prized possession, and that's something you can't live without. What is it?
The only thing that I know, and you're asking somebody, by the way, who's downsized and gone almost minimalist for this whole van life thing.
That's why I'm asking.
Bear with me. I would have to make sure that if I had nothing else, I had my iPhone. And not because I love my iPhone so much, but because I've literally written books on my iPhone with that tool, I can rebuild.
Okay. Last question. You and your wife have taken a cruise, but found yourself on a deserted island. Thankfully, you have managed to have on hand some matches for fire, a filter for drinking water. You're a Boy Scout after all.
Yeah.
But the only entertainment in your backpack is a book and a solar-powered MP3 player. What is the book and what's the genre of music? I would say favorite artist, but, sometimes that's too complicated for people to get their head around. So I'll say genre of music they're listening to until a Coast Guard comes and rescues you.
Okay, now am I having to entertain both me and my wife or just me in this scenario?
I'm going to say you, because I'm having the interview with you and she has her own book. She's over there, got her nose all buried, and you can't use the Bible, and it can be a genre of music if you can't quite get your hand around or head around one artist.
The book I would carry with me would be Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card. That's the book that started it all for me. If I'm picking as much as a genre of music, I'd have to go with, I think I'd probably go with like blues, R&B.
All right. That is going to do it. Any questions you have for me, young man?
No, man. I am honored you allowed me to come on. I'm sorry I had to beg for it. So
you would have gotten there eventually, dude. It's all good. I was making my way to you.
I was teasing you when I reached out about it.
I know.
But I'm very glad that you and I know we haven't talked all that much. We've talked a handful of times and on the phone and what have you, but we do have our good friend Todd in common, but we kind of go way back. So, I've been very impressed by everything you've done. I don't know if I've ever told you that, but
no, you haven't. Thank you.
You're an incredible talent yourself. So I'm honored to be able to share some airwaves with you, man.
Yeah, thank you. It has been fun. And I'm, you know, I feel like it's just the beginning. I think this Thriller Zone has taken off. It's bringing back my first love, which is radio, which I kind of turned my back on about 20 years ago. I mean, I put in 25 years and then I stepped out for 20 years, but I'm back in and I feel like I'm home again. So,
yeah, I love podcasting. I miss radio. But you know, this is probably better in a lot of ways.
Dude, it's the only thing that isn't the same is we both made, I can speak for myself, a lot of money doing that. And I'm making very little money now, but I'm doing it for the love and the money will come. I've always believed that. That's kind of how I started that career.
Yeah.
And it is better, Kevin, because our radio is everywhere.
Right.
I was just doing some metrics on this show and we are being heard around the world and it shows me where they're popping up and what cities it's insane because you can take it wherever you want. Whereas terrestrial radio,
I have more listeners in Australia and New Zealand than I had my entire radio career.
Australia loves us for some reason.
It's the accents, I think. They like the American accents.
I did so much research on Sydney, Melbourne, and the Gold Coast that I've doing between Google flyovers and just deep research that I feel like I've been there. And I told Tammy, I said, babe, we have to go there sometime. Well, congratulations on this phenomenal success of all these different series. Dude, thank you so much for your time. Let me get out of here and get working on this.
Okay, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Kevin. It was great to catch up with you. Now, on next week's show, the Thriller Zone is happy to welcome the writing duo of Mullen and Mabry. Steph Mullen and Nicole Mabry will be on hand to discuss their latest gripping thriller, The Family Tree. Number one New York Times bestselling author Lisa Gardner calls The Family Tree a taut and timely tale that keeps the shocks coming right up to the climactic end. I hope you'll make plans to catch all the fun. And thanks again for listening. That's it for now. I'm David Temple, and I'll see you next time on The Thriller Zone.